Paul is extraordinary. And the information that he provides on the normal legal committee list, his willingness and ability to provide us with information that is fact-based and science-based to help defend clients is extraordinary. And I'm going to be talking a little bit about some civil cases as I go through this. I believe, and this is not a legal judgment, so it can't be used against you, but if one defends a DUID case without having reviewed the materials in the CD, without having paid attention to what Paul has said, and without having mastered the materials, is a breach of the standard of care. Because how can we go in and defend people if we don't know the fact-based science? There is so much bullshit that is going on in our criminal justice system. And then I'll get to what I'm going to talk about. We have people, I believe, confined doing prison sentences on the basis of bite mark evidence, tool mark evidence, fingerprint evidence, hair analysis that means nothing. Yet we have science that can defend people who are being charged and whose liberty is being taken from them. And so I just get, my head is spinning trying to remember all that Paul talks about and trying to master it. I can't tell you how many times I have seen questions on our local lawyer, great listserv, about carboxy. Well, carboxy means that the THC is already through your system. You can't be impaired, but people keep asking that question. So why am I here? I'm here because I love Normal. I have loved Normal. I love the people with Normal. I was actually just recently updating my website for some city council stuff. And I was doing a newspaper search. And I found, when we had our normal meetings in Santa Fe, and Michael Stepanian would call me and we would do stuff, in 1989, we protested the fact that some private bus system wasn't allowing the LGBT community to advertise. And there was a news article in the Santa Fe New Mexican about Normal's legal committee standing up about that. So we've been around for a long, long time. And I remember going to the Key West meetings before the sentencing guidelines were even adopted, and we were being taught about how we had to approach this. So Keith called and he said, would you speak? And I thought, yeah, I'd like to. I haven't done it for a while. I was working on a big civil case. And I said, you know, I'm sort of working on a big civil case and I've been doing a lot of civil cases in my practice and they come from my criminal defense roots. So I'd like to talk about or try and figure out how I can make a presentation about how you can use the criminal defense skills to a degree in a civil practice, because it seemed like I was doing more and more cases. And, you know, I just got, and I can't say too much about it, but the largest fee in my career, which is probably similar to what Jerry charges for a battery case in the front of a justice of the peace in Texas. But I feel pretty good about it. So it took a lot out of me. But it was my criminal defense roots that enabled me to be able to do it. So I'd like to see how many people here, number one, are from Colorado. Well, you know, we were doing these quite a while ago and then they stopped in Aspen. And then was it maybe 10 years ago we started up again? And that first year, well, we have 30, 40 people, Keith, at max. You know, and then when the breaks happened and people didn't come back and it was right before lunch and, you know, it was a little lonely but a little comforting because there was this core. That's when I first met Lauren. I met Jeff. I saw John again after a number of years. And then each year it built and it built. And I remember Brian Vincente. I don't think any of us would have thought then that Colorado would be legalized. that there would be a groundswell of opinion, that there would be a critical mass that would change things. So what I urge you is to have a critical mass to look out to defend the rights of the oppressed, those who are harmed, those who are victimized, those who are in need of help. You know, I titled my talk something like Helping People Protecting Rights, because that's what we do. Whether it's through the criminal defense process or whether it is through a civil practice that vindicates people whose rights have been denied and deprived to them, or people who have been harmed and grievously injured or lost someone, to get full and fair compensation for what they're entitled to under the law that oftentimes, and to be candid with you, one can never replace a loved one. One can never replace the use of limbs. But our system somehow gears a civil rights violation for damages in money, dollars, or the loss of a life. So how many people, let me just see in terms of what we're talking about here, would tend or feel that you are criminal defense lawyers, primarily? And how many people feel that you are primarily civil law lawyers? So there's an interesting mix, because in my practice, although I consider myself in my heart, my soul, my core, a criminal defense lawyer, most of my practice now is doing civil work. I'm a sole practitioner. I never developed a law firm, and cases would come. But they have a derivation in many, many ways from criminal law, and it's my criminal law background, and that's what I hope to share with you, that you can identify issues that I think lead you forward to help people, because that's what this is all about. Another thought. I believe that over the course of the, I hope we can do something about it. We know that the Innocence Project, started by Barry Scheck, has freed people who have been wrongfully convicted and are on death row, or had gotten their sentences commuted. But I think that there is an enormous number of people in prisons throughout this country who have been convicted of murder and serving life sentences or decades on the basis of flawed evidence, flawed testimony, improper convictions, and we haven't even scratched the surface of those folks. So when you go home, if you get the opportunity to help out, please do, because I think, you know, when the resources go to those death penalty cases, those folks who were just looking at life, well, it was perceived that they were just looking at life, because death is different, and death is different. So we have to pay attention to that. So how did that U.S. Supreme Court case happen? Well, it happened because a guy, you know, silly stuff, it was a fluke. It wasn't, I mean, yes, I did a good thing, but it started because there was a civil rights case in northern New Mexico against a New Mexico state police officer. The guy got acquitted at, he got beat up, he got acquitted at his trial. During the trial, they found out that the cop had beat up several other people. So a friend of mine said, Stephen, I got this guy, I found out about him at a trial. Why don't you send in a New Mexico tort, why don't you send in a tort claims notice? Now, those of you who do civil work know, if you have a tort claim statute, you usually have a relatively short period of time to send in a tort claims notice. Our law says 90 days. Our statute of limitations was 2 years. So I said, okay, sort of naively, blindly, whatever. I sent in the notice. They said, screw you. It's too late. Our statute of limitations is 2 years. And you didn't send in your tort claims notice in 90 days. Well, that case, we won at the district court level, saying civil rights cases, the statute of limitations for personal injury actions is based upon the personal injury statute of the state. State appealed to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, who wrote this massive opinion showing the split in the circuits, and we fought against going to the U.S. Supreme Court. Supreme Court accepted cert, and there I am. It was like a bar mitzvah. They sent me 8 tickets for my family. You know? And there's my Aunt Sarah, as I am nervous as shit. You know, she's in the halls of the Supreme Court, "Stephen!" I'll never forget that, you know. But it had a basis in criminal law. Terry Seaton was convicted of first-degree murder in Eddy County, Carlsbad, New Mexico, Eddy County, and sentenced to life for heinous murder. A baker was castrated and he had hot oil poured all over him and had testicles put in his mouth. And Bob Rothstein, a wonderful lawyer from Santa Fe, New Mexico, was a little ill, more than a little, but who's ill now. He and I were public defenders, and we started together. Bob found out about the case. I was the head of the public defender's office in Santa Fe at the time. So, "Bob, you do the work, we'll pick up the slack." And then I got recruited to do some AG work and special prosecutions for a year and a half. And then left because I could not stand being at a table in a case where someone I was sitting next to was asking that some 65-year-old man that we had convicted because he had engaged in an act of bribery be sent to jail. That bothered me. It was Charlie Davis, Cisco. Oh, by the way, I should stop right now and tell everybody. Cisco McSorley is here. Cisco is one of our treasures in New Mexico. He is a state senator, and he is at the core of what we are doing in New Mexico in our limited territory. So I couldn't do it anymore. Oh, actually, Charlie, as the lawyer, and he was a nice guy, but as he was walking back, Charlie got up and said, "You know, I really didn't appreciate what you said," you know, in the courtroom. I said, "Well, you know, I opened up my own practice," and Terry's was the first case. And so what we had to do was post-conviction criminal defense work. And we were able to show perjured testimony, withheld testimony, people recanted. We went through two post-conviction hearings. We had a week-long habeas corpus hearing. And at the end of that, and it was in Sandoval County, Bernalillo, New Mexico, little north of Albuquerque. No one knew about the case. By the end of the week, the courtroom was full of African Americans from Albuquerque, and the judge released him from the courtroom. You know, think of the movie The Hurricane, that's exactly what it was. And that will stay with me the rest of my life. Because that's why we do what we do. We help people. And if the case doesn't come in because of where we live or whatever it is, and it's a civil case, I believe that we have the ability and obligation to help folks who are in need of help in a civil context as well. It does not diminish or denigrate from the criminal defense perspective. It adds an element that is helpful. It adds an element that is integral to our system of justice. Because there aren't, forget about the marketers. Forget about the billboard people. I mean, you know, I have my strong feelings against all that shit. But if people come to you, they come to you based upon your reputation. They come to you based upon the fact that it's word of mouth. They come to you, it seems to me, based upon the fact that there is an acknowledgement that there is a person, you, who will help. Now, in helping, you have to develop skills. So you transfer the skills from the criminal defense practice to a civil context. And the easiest way of doing it, actually, is through that civil rights lawsuit. Because in the Terry Seaton case, what we did was we filed a Section 1983 federal civil rights lawsuit, civil, not criminal, against the sheriff, against the sheriffs, against the county, against the DA, because the DA was willfully participating in that process. And we got a jury verdict in favor of Terry. Now, it wasn't as large as we wanted because Terry's alibi for the murder that we proved was that he was breaking into a clothing store in Clovis, New Mexico, and there was no way that he could get back to Carlsbad to have committed the murder. A fact. You have to concede where you must and move forward. We had to concede it. We had to prove it. But it proved he was innocent. So we could have gotten the bigger verdict, but some jurors felt that he should have served probably a couple years anyway for that burglary. That's a side point. It's just what happens in life. But civil rights cases are a natural conjunction in many ways to a criminal defense practice, because we know from doing the criminal defense practice, we see the police misconduct that is just pervasive. We see the excessive force cases. We see the excessive force cases that lead to death. You know, this is nothing new, what's been happening this past year. It's been happening as long as I've been practicing law. Racism is a part of our system of justice, quotes, and we need to see it head on. We need to deal with it. We need to not ignore it, and we need to talk about it. And just like the facts that come forward from a presentation like Paul's, we need to be able to confront the existing racism and continuing racism in this country, not just against African Americans, against Hispanics, against minorities. It's there. So in a criminal context, if you do criminal cases, you're also going to be finding that you're going to see these civil rights violations. You're going to see the First Amendment violations at demonstrations. You're going to see actual First Amendment violations for professors who speak out at universities. You're going to see the termination cases where someone has been deprived of due process of law because there's policies and procedure manuals and they don't follow their policies and procedures. And you're going to be confronted with the defense of qualified immunity. How did that go? Racism, an undeniable factor in PR.
Russ is great.
Because he's not even here. I must be channeling it. I don't know. But it's pretty amazing. I just glanced over this, like racism. I didn't prepare a PowerPoint. I was afraid it wasn't going to work. You know, and that's another thing that you learn when you're doing a trial practice, is to make sure you've already come and you know that the computer is going to work with whatever you have on your disk. Because the last thing you want to have happen is to have everybody be watching you while you're doing either, you know, not the voir dire, but the opening statement. You plug it in, or you're trying to ask a witness a question, and all of a sudden there's the pause while you're trying to get the thing to work. So a little trial tip, experiment first, make sure it all works.
Prezi.com.
What was that?
Prezi.com.
Okay.
So it's online.
Write it down. So. So we have that aspect of, you know, the civil rights cases. But the qualified immunity defense, everybody needs to know about if you're doing civil rights cases. And it wasn't so much of a problem in excessive force cases because we know that the law is clear. You have a constitutional right to not have the shit beat out of you. I mean, essentially. You have a that's an overstatement. But want by law enforcement officers. And that right is clearly established. But in order to succeed in a civil rights case, you have to prove that you have a constitutional right and that that constitutional right is clearly established law. Because if you can't get over that hurdle, then you're not going to get to a jury, and defendants use that to be able to stop you on a motion to dismiss in federal court if you don't do civil work. A motion to dismiss is essentially, you file the case, you state well-pleaded facts, defendants come in, they say you haven't stated facts that are sufficient to state a cause of action, then you gotta brief that thing, and then they file their motion for summary judgment saying that there's no material facts in dispute, we're entitled to judgment as a matter of law, and that's most often where qualified immunity comes up. And the judges are somewhat hostile to civil rights cases. It really depends on the judge. I mean, Obama has, though he's not had opportunities to appoint people to the Supreme Court very much, he has been undoing, to the extent he's been able to in Congress, to do undoing the damage that was started by George H.W. Bush and continued by his son, of stacking the federal courts with conservative judges who will be there for 40 years or more. And it's had a major impact, and there's been a shift. So it really depends on the district that you're in. I know in New Mexico, it hasn't been enough of a shift. And that the judges in federal court, some of the more experienced practitioners would say, particularly in diversity cases and personal injury cases, which I hope to be able to talk about a little bit, that's where good cases go to die. So that's a problem, which is unfortunate because it means that people are not getting their day in court because the judges tend to favor those in power. The judges tend to have a conservative view of what's involved.
Steve?
Yes.
No, it's even worse in federal court because when you try to bring this Monell claim to try to hold the agency responsible for what the officer did, they're very hostile. They don't even want to hear those claims and don't even let you do discovery on them a lot and try to dispose of them early. You know, they go to case management conference and they'll say, well, what's this Monell claim doing here? You know, they don't want to hear. And that's fundamentally how these police agencies keep getting away with it year after year. Nobody can really challenge their training and their procedures.
Right. It's the policy of the entity.
Right, right.
And what qualified immunity does is once they file their qualified immunity motion, it shuts down discovery. So you can't even get into their lack of training, their lack of supervision, their lack of oversight. So it's a challenging world. It's a challenging concern. Another aspect of that I think lends itself to criminal defense practitioners is a professional licensed defense. So in professional licensed defense, which I do a fair amount of now, I don't know how it started, but I do, you know, you have somebody who has a license. They are alleged to have done something wrong. There is generally, this is the statutory scheme in New Mexico, there is generally a board that oversees acupuncturists, dentists, massage therapists, licensed mental health counselors, and the like, a wide range of things. And we have something called the Uniform Licensing Act. And in many ways, though, the standard is very, very different than proof beyond a reasonable doubt, which is what's so important. The judges don't buy this too much. The presumption of innocence and proof beyond a reasonable doubt in these professional licensing cases, you don't have that. All they have to do is prove by a preponderance of the evidence the violation. So as criminal defense lawyers, we learn how to investigate cases. We learn how to dig into details. We learn how to deal with facts. We learn how to make people prove things. Well, I suggest to you that in professional licensing cases, that same approach applies, except it's different. Because what happens is, in a professional licensing case, and this goes back to what Sean was talking about earlier on in the regulatory process. I mean, it's administrative law. I never thought when I was going to law school that I'd be doing administrative law, but when you think about it, it's administrative law. The grounds for appeal are very limited. So what one does early on is most of the times crucial to the outcome of the case later on. I can't tell you how many times I've gotten called by people, but it's been a lot, of a lawyer being contacted by somebody who was served with a complaint by the licensing board, and they really didn't do anything. And then the next thing that happens, we'll deal with that at a hearing, is they get something called a notice of contemplated action, which we can analogize to something like an indictment, because you're going to a hearing unless you work out a deal. But if you respond to a complaint, let's just say someone calls you, a dentist calls you, a doctor calls you, a mental health counselor calls you, the wide range of licensed professions. You have to respond as best you can to the complaint early on because these boards have complaint committees. And the complaint committee could very well say, well, we don't find that there's sufficient grounds to go forward and dismiss the complaint. And then you have saved the professional, number one, public embarrassment, because that's what happens if a paper picks up on it. And this is their career. I mean, this is their license. This is their livelihood. And the complaint committee could very well say, the complaint is dismissed. And that's the end of it. And that person goes forward. Because oftentimes, people make complaints. There's judgments made based upon a lack of information. So if you give information early on, you can dictate oftentimes the way that client is going to be leading their life in the future. And that's what it's about. So it's very similar to a criminal case in that way. I mean, they're not going to jail, but if they lose their license, if their license is suspended, even if they get a reprimand of some sort, it gets reported to the National Data Bank, their malpractice insurance premiums go sky high, they get embarrassed in the community. It's something that can be avoided, and oftentimes is not, simply because people don't act quickly, which is very important. It becomes important in the criminal defense practice when someone comes into the office to try and quickly get a handle on the case. You get a handle on the case by doing the investigation, you get a handle on the case, well, first by meeting the client, getting to know the client, getting to know what the accusation is, and what I always loved, although never practiced, was get the fee and don't return it. I mean, that's something we were always told. I was never really good at that. I don't know about getting the fee, or I certainly was always relatively flexible about those kinds of things. But I always sort of giggled when that line went on. But so the client comes into the criminal defense lawyer's office, and we know the facts. We know what's there. And there are times, and I would be willing to bet that this has happened to almost all of you, where that file, maybe, sometimes in a drug case, is off to the side of your desk, and you're waiting. Not, you know, the indictment, maybe a complaint was filed in what is our magistrate court, but you've been able to write a letter, you've been able to do something, and the case just sort of sits there. And it sits there, and it sits there. And you're sort of like, I don't know if you're like me, but I'm worried. I don't know what to do. If I make a phone call, am I going to give that case some life? Or if I don't make a phone call, is that case just going to be forgotten about because the prosecutor is working on other things? It happened to me. And, you know, at a year out, you have to tell the client, look, I can't tell you that this case will go away. I can tell you, you're probably never going to get a letter that said it went away, but it may very well go away. And that happens. And it happens in the licensing context too, where you might just get that letter of dismissal, or it might be too complicated and no one really meets the time limits, because there are time limits for filing a formal complaint, at least in New Mexico, under the Uniform Licensing Act, of 2 years from the date when they found about the offense. So I encourage and urge people to be open to handling those types of cases. But be aware of the fact that when you handle those kinds of cases, and as criminal defense lawyers, here's something that we don't pay enough attention to, because it's a whole totally different process. The record that is made at that administrative hearing stays with you forever. And it is practically impossible to supplement that record. So, unlike the criminal case, we're going to have a full-blown trial. In the professional licensing context, what's going to happen is you're going to have a hearing, either in front of a hearing officer or in front of a board. And I think that these are probably universal type things. The board, oftentimes, they consider themselves consumer protectors. But let me tell you, I've been in front of boards and had to deal with people who allow that power, just like judges, to go to their head. And they know better and they know more. And it then becomes very, very difficult, because you have a totally different standard that's involved, where that's not a reasonable standard. It's not necessarily a fact-based standard. It's very much ego-driven. We're the board, we know best. But the record that is made at the administrative hearing level is the record, if you lose the case, that the judge appealing, to whom you will appeal, at least in New Mexico, goes to a trial court level and then court of appeals level, that's the record that you're stuck with. And it's a substantial evidence rule, which very basically sort of means if there's evidence that supports it, you know, you're out of luck. So in the civil context, we can use that lower standard to help people vindicate their rights to get compensation for that, for the harms that they've suffered. In the professional licensing context, it's a low standard. It's, you know, the preponderance of the evidence. They don't even know what the preponderance of the evidence means. And here you have a record that is with you, and the judge is not really allowed to challenge the record. The judge, other than to find mistakes of law, other than to find that there's been arbitrary, capricious action on the part of the board, other than to find that there's been a violation of the law, the judge is stuck with the record that the judge has to accept, finds a violation against the client. So let me talk about the preponderance of the evidence standard for a moment and shift back and forth, because what I want to do is show how these, you know, there is a interweaving, and it's almost like a dance. And you have to know, it seems to me, when to move, when to stop, when to stay in place, when to back up, in order to do these cases back and forth. In the materials, what I did was, I'm going to commend Paul's materials. Everybody should go home and read them. Mine are sort of interesting because what I thought about was the different types of keys that I call pearls. I was reading too many medical texts. Maybe I let that doctor thing go to my head. You know, like, here's a pearl. You know, here's some sense of little bit of wisdom that I've learned in certain different types of cases. But I was doing a white collar case. And in that white collar case, it was a bank fraud case. And the only issue, and my client was guilty. She had used a credit, she was a trust officer, all public record. She had used a trust account for a client who had Alzheimer's. She shouldn't have used the credit card. But she didn't do nearly what the bank was claiming she did, or the prosecutor was claiming that she did. And we had, so I worked out a deal, essentially, where she pled to one count of bank fraud. I said, but we are not conceding in any way whatsoever the loss. Not at all. And everybody I talked to, oh, it's a preponderance of the evidence. We never do this. We never do that. Well, I filed a 40-page objection to the pre-sentence report. I disputed every single fact that I could. I conceded where I had to, but I disputed every single fact that I could. I filed, in addition to the objection to the pre-sentence report, and I filed, and I started early on with the probation officer because I wanted to show the record. I wanted the judge to see that we were objecting to this at the very beginning, and it was the government that was wasting her time. There were disputed facts, and if you look in the sentencing guidelines, if you have disputed facts, and there's not an indicia of reliability, you're entitled to an evidentiary hearing. Well, I also had the motion for downward departure. I had a sentencing memorandum. But that case ended up with a 5-day evidentiary hearing just on the issue of the amount of the loss. And everybody was saying preponderance of the evidence. So I went to the Tenth Circuit, UJI, and it said evidence. Preponderance. Everybody was assuming preponderance of the evidence means you have to accept what they say. I said to the judge, wait a second, you got to balance the evidence. That means that there's evidence. It's not that you just accept what the probation officer says. It's not that you just accept what the prosecutor says. We dispute these facts. You have to balance this. And so what was in excess of $100,000 loss ended up $4,000. Now, my client got a little bit of time because the judge didn't think that she accepted some responsibility because she had different issues, but she got 8 months as opposed to years. That was a big deal for her. It was a big deal for me. I put a lot of time and effort into it, and I didn't follow the rule that Jerry, and I don't know if Jerry ever made that comment, but I didn't know what the case involved at the beginning. I was just charging on an hourly basis. Client runs out of money. What am I going to do? File a motion to get out of the case just when I got the judge listening? No, I mean, that's bullshit. So I took a big hit financially. I wasn't on the CJA panel. I got on that. You know, the client filed for bankruptcy, owing me almost six figures. But the fact was the dedication as a criminal defense lawyer that I had starting out as a public defender is what enabled me to go forward, to not look at my client and be angry, to say, I have a job to do. I committed to do this thing, and I'm going to follow it. I'm going to do what's necessary. And that leads me to personal injury cases. Why do I do them? I don't do them because, and I don't take small cases that are little accident things. I mean, maybe that's elitist or ego on my part, but I want to do something that's challenging. And I've done some wrongful death cases, and let me tell you, there is no way, no way, that our legal system can compensate somebody for the loss of a loved one. And it is our job, if you choose to do these cases, to be sensitive to that, to understand that, to understand that there is grief. And everybody grieves in different ways. And people may say things, and people may do things, and people may act in ways that we wouldn't necessarily act, but unless we're walking in their shoes, we can't pass judgment. If you've lost a wife, if your child has lost his mother, it's enormous. And our legal system has a way of compensating people, but it's not really compensation, so sure, the lawyer makes money. Yeah, and I benefit from that. But what I am also doing is I am helping provide closure. And in these accident cases where someone has been horribly maimed or someone has had a life-altering experience, it is, again, the criminal defense process that enables us to do the fact-based investigation that is required, that says to us, you know, this may not be a case for me. I don't have the money to do this. In the materials, they talk about medical malpractice cases. How many people here have actually done a medical malpractice case? So a couple of us. They are hard. Man, let me tell you, the defense lawyers, they're going to stand up and use every single thing they can to defend the doc, even if the doc did something egregious. There's a bias in favor of the doctor. People like doctors who want to help. So, I mean, I think the studies show that there's like 80,000, I think that's the number, 80,000 deaths due to negligence in hospitals per year. I mean, think of that. That is a staggering number. But not all of those cases can be prosecuted. I mean, people don't, these cases are expensive. Even a wrongful death case is expensive. So you have to, before you get involved in this stuff, you have to prepare, you have to understand the facts, you have to maybe associate with somebody else, you have to learn and never stop learning. And I think that's the key also to criminal defense. We have to learn and never stop learning. And it's a lot. It is not easy to take in all this information. It is not easy to understand the law with regard to how cannabis affects us. It's not easy to understand a surgical procedure. It's not easy to understand how someone could be quadriplegic having walked into a chiropractor's office and be carried out on a stretcher. I did a case like that. It's not easy to get a phone call from somebody who says, do you handle personal injury and wrongful death cases, and to have a conversation for 15 minutes and, you know, saying yes, excuse me, who died? And the response is, I'm going to die. I mean, think about that. I'm going to die. And then to be able to work with that person while they have stage 4 lung cancer simply because somebody did not read an x-ray properly and put off taking the deposition to perpetuate the testimony of the only person who really knows what happened, using the rules of civil procedure, because not only do we use the rules of criminal procedure in criminal cases, we got to learn the rules of civil procedure. And there's a rule, 27, in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. It's also the same thing in at New Mexico rules, which allows us, under certain limited circumstances, to take a deposition to perpetuate the testimony of somebody who was seriously ill. And that's what it's supposed to be. It's not really supposed to be for pretrial discovery, although it was used like that up in the Minnesota, I think, highway case. But to perpetuate the testimony of someone who's going to die. And I did that. And I want to tell you how gut-wrenching it was. And I did it because I learned. I read. I expanded, and I share with you that you need to expand your comfort zone. There's an extraordinary collection of books put out by, it's called trialguides.com. There's a guy by the name of David Ball. Anybody hear of David Ball? David Ball and is not a lawyer, but he's done studies showing how people respond to damage claims and showing the enormous success that insurance companies have had making people think that injured people are just trying to get money as opposed to be compensated for the full harm in a fair amount for what they've suffered. It's called David Ball on Damages. I suggest that you all read it. Then there's another book, it's called The Reptile, and it's by Don Keenan. And Don Keenan says that we all act from this reptilian base. Fight or flight. And there's another book called Rules of the Road. But I worked with my client, Deborah. And, you know, everybody has to do it their way. I read what Don Keenan wrote in The Reptile about the reptilian response. And I couldn't quite, you know, he wanted to have a bulletin board and go over the facts and spend 3 days with the client. That wasn't working. It wasn't going to work. But I went to Albuquerque for 3 days in a row, and I let my client talk. And I did something that my wife Marguerite will share with you I rarely do. I bit my tongue. And there she is. Proof. I just listened, and I let her talk. And what she did, and I think that this can be used also in criminal cases, she talked about her feelings. She talked about what it meant to feel like she was going to die. She talked about what it meant to her that she would never see grandchildren. Things that in a year she hadn't talked, because she and I both avoided the issue of doing her deposition, because if we did her deposition, it meant she was going to die. But then I was starting to worry, because I also do legal malpractice. She knew that they, you know, what happened. She knew what the guy told her. Don't worry about that. Oh, it's just some little deposit, you know? And it was a malicious tumor, and there was an x-ray report that never made it to the PA. But in the context of doing this kind of work, I submit to you that we empower our clients. We empower ourselves and our profession and continue the quest for justice. So thank you.
Wow, thank you so much. So that wraps up today. And if you have any questions, please make sure you ask. Yes, Marguerite?
Hi.
Marguerite?
Add something, I don't need a microphone, thank you very much.
Okay, that's
Stephen Farber is my husband, and I want to say something about all that he does. I live with him. I'm a school teacher. 2 years ago, May 1st, thank you very much for that, I appreciate it. May 1st, 2013, I saved a child. Child was falling, and she said to me, Mrs. F, I'm falling. I pick the child up, I get the child out of the way, and boom, I kick what she's falling on. Fly up in the air, bam, land on this left side of my body, and I have to explain to you, I've had two major surgeries. I had spinal cord surgery, I have lumbar surgery. I have not worked for 2 years, I'm on workman's compensation. They bit us, they fought us, they kicked us, every single thing that Stephen is telling you about insurance companies, about malpractice, they beat me down. 33 years I devoted to my life to the Santa Fe Public Schools. 14 years of my life, I worked at the National Dance Institute. The prop was in the way, I saved a child. Stephen and I went through hell for 2 years. Two major surgeries I went through in less than 11 months, all right? My husband, and he didn't mention it, and I knew he was not going to, he won my workman compensation case. Yeah. And please, look at me now. You would never believe cervical spine, C3, 4, 5, 6, tonsil 8, okay? L4, L5, mestizos. My entire family, took us 2 years to get here. And I just want to let you know that the kind of work he does is he beats them. Because workman's comp is going to beat you down.
Yeah.
Insurance's company, especially workman's comp, will beat and beat and beat. They're great for the first 9 weeks. Then as soon as you take your opportunity within the law to choose another doctor other than workman's compensation, then they say, oh no, we're not going to play ball anymore. Fought and fought and fought. No, Stephen, I don't care if I'm taking people's time. I think they need to know this. I do. I live with a lawyer. And I'm proof of the pudding. Here I am. But we worked hard.
Yeah, and that is the message. You work hard for your clients. Your clients are real people. Your clients are in real need. And when you have somebody like Stephen on your side that doesn't take the no for the answer, whether it's criminal defense or in the civil rights field, you go to the mat for your clients. That's what it's about. And Stephen does that.
That's what he does all the time, and I'm proof of the pudding. So thank you. I know I'm not a lawyer. I'm a teacher. But for the last 2 years, I've been a lawyer listening to my husband. So thank you very much.